On Sunday in the New York Times Magazine, author Stephen Johnson pointedly asked, how is today's creative class faring? His own analysis of available data drew Johnson to conclude that the much-threatened creative apocalypse hasn't materialized. That contrarian conclusion might be expected from a writer who has also argued that pop culture fosters complex thinking and not intellectual sloth, as many suppose. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. Not surprisingly, many in the creative communities have struck back at the Johnson piece. They see a world of hurt in the wake of the internet age for all of media. Rob Levine, a former Billboard executive editor and author of Free Ride, How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back, is among those best qualified to make a rejoinder. Levine has written often about the destructive impact of digital technology on culture and media, particularly as it affects writers and artists. He joins me now from his messy apartment, which doubles as his office in New York City. Rob Levine, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Thank you very much. Only a corner of it doubles as my office, though.
Okay. Just enough room for your laptop. Well, listen, Rob Levine, I think we all would like to think that the creative economy is thriving, and that's certainly what Stephen Johnson suggested in his New York Times Magazine piece. But I guess, frankly, you just don't see it that way.
Well, there are three levels on which this piece is wrong. And let me just start by saying, I know Stephen slightly. I worked with him years ago. I think he's a very smart thinker. His book about why pop culture is making you smarter is absolutely brilliant, although I stopped liking pop culture after I realized it was good for me. I'm joking. But, you know, he's a smart guy. And, you know, the idea that he would have something to say about this is not a silly one. There's three problems. One is you have to really understand what data you're looking for. He's looking at a lot of data that's not great data. For example, he's looking at, you know, U.S. occupational data collected by the Department of Labor. That doesn't apply very well to people in bands. What it does track is people who are musicians and singers, and in another category, music directors and composers. All of those people are involved in music, but a lot of them aren't creating original work in the copyright sense. I'm not being critical of what they do. I'm just saying it may not give you a sense of what's being created. Some of them are high school music teachers. They're playing in orchestras in Broadway. They're bar bands and wedding singers. All these things are important. All these things are wonderful. Don't get me wrong. But digital technology, specifically the kind of digital technology he's talking about in terms of Napster, hasn't changed what they do that much. A lot of weddings book bands. A lot of weddings booked bands 20 years ago. I'm not an expert on the business, but I don't think it's changed that much. A lot of bars have bands. Bars still have bands. People take piano lessons. Some of this hasn't changed very much. Within those statistics, how many people are wedding singers? How many people are piano teachers? And how many people are in bands creating and recording original music in the sense that copyright law is sort of aimed at encouraging original creations? We don't know. We do know that, you know, self-employed musicians are up. That's a little closer to the mark. But some piano teachers are self-employed. Some of them may also be self-involved. I'm sorry. I meant to say some of them are self-employed. We don't know. To what extent is the increase in self-employed musicians correlates with the decrease in employment among musicians? For instance, right now, if you looked at journalists, you'd see a lot of self-employed journalists. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is freelance journalism growing? Or is freelance journalism growing because a lot of people got laid off and they don't have staff jobs anymore?
Well, you know, Rob, I have to jump in because I was a freelance journalist for many years, and it always troubled me that whenever I introduced myself and said that I was a freelance journalist, people were thinking, oh, right, he's unemployed.
The thing I always hate is your friends who are moving. They're like, hey, I'm growing out of this a little bit. When I was younger, people were like, oh, can you, you know, help me move or like wait for the UPS guy like you're sitting around all day?
Exactly. My mother thought I was smoking cigarettes and listening to jazz music, but that's another thing. So you're right. I mean, there's more to this than just the data. And I think that might be where you've got an argument with Stephen Johnson's conclusion, right?
Well, that's only one argument. So let me first unpack that a little. I don't want to say the data is not good. Let's just say the data may not be very good at measuring what he's trying to measure. And he's talking about people who are fully employed. I mean, you know, like, are the members of Bon Jovi, are they part owners of the Bon Jovi LLC? Are they employees of John Bon Jovi? And are they full-time freelance or contract employees of John Bon Jovi, if that's so? The answer is, we don't know. The other question is, because a lot of this is self-reported, you know, if you're using statistics that depend on the insight and economic knowledge of our nation's rock drummers, you may end up with statistics that aren't so good. I know I'm going out on a limb there. And this, you see this with all the statistics Stephen Johnson uses. You know, he's talking about an increase in worldwide revenues in the concert business. Well, first of all, some of that's because of new markets. You know, a decent number of bands tour China now. 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. You're also talking about a lot of consolidation in the concert business. Things are measured a little better. People in the music business know that, you know, he's using Polestar data, which isn't that good anyway. And lastly, like, a lot of other things happened in the concert business. You know, when I was a kid in 1985, if you saw somebody, you know, if the guy next to you at a Peter Gabriel concert was smoking a joint and he was 44, you're like, wow, that dude's old to be going to a concert. Now I'm 44. And I go to some concerts, and there's a lot of people way older than I am. You know, like, the audience for attending popular music events is much bigger than it was years ago.
That's a great point, Rob Levine, because, I mean, you would see just a very narrow group that would even bother to show up. Today, they're enjoying not only the music, but the entertainment aspect. It's like going out to a movie or something like that. Everybody does it.
And there's also more music to go see. Right now, you know, you have bands on their 40th anniversary tour. In 1985, when I started going to concerts, there were no bands from 1945 that were drawing big audiences. The very idea would have been laughed at. Now, just to be very clear, I'm not saying that this is why the concert business has grown. What I am saying is, in the space of 20 minutes, I can come up with five different theories as to why the concert business has grown. Stephen Johnson gave one theory. He said, maybe it's because of the decline in recorded music. But just because those two things happened at the same time doesn't mean that one caused another. The world is a lot warmer than it was 15 years ago, but I don't think it's because of Napster.
Well, it could be a factor, though, and that's the point. It's unpacking all of this is very difficult to do. And across the creative economy, we're lumping together musicians, we're lumping together writers, also television and film producers, and the circumstances in those different industries are all very different indeed. The music business is one thing, the TV and film business quite another.
So let me get to my second point. What are we trying to measure here, right? I mean, like, what question should you be asking? He's sort of saying, like, well, you know, I see that the music business is doing, the artists are doing well, and the film business and the television business is doing well. But again, you have no, so the first thing is the data. The second issue is correlation and causation, right? Like, the recorded music business is worse, the concert business is better, but that doesn't mean one caused the other. And, you know, the television business is at an all-time high. You know, I think there's 350 new shows being produced, counting online outlets, this fall. I don't think that's caused by Napster. I have no way of knowing. But I don't think Stephen Johnson does either. Like, you can take a lot of statistics. The first thing is, am I looking at the right statistics? I think he didn't. The second thing is, are those statistics showing any kind of causation? First of all, I don't think those statistics are good enough to establish causation in the first place. Secondly, I don't think he's looking at them in a causative way. He says, well, if you look at the recorded music business going down and the concert business going up, maybe that same money is going from place to place.
But that same money could also be going to cutlery. I mean, I don't – just because those are the same things in the same rough category, it doesn't mean that they have any effect on each other. I mean, just to be clear, they might. They might. But I'm not suggesting that they don't. I'm suggesting that all I'm saying is you can't establish that from the data, and I'm not sure why anyone would say that you could, partly because the data is so messy, but also because, you know, data will always give you a detailed answer, but it's only the right answer if you ask it the right question, and the data doesn't tell you. It's like the magic eight ball, right? It doesn't tell you that you're asking the wrong question. It only says yes, no, or answer cloudy, ask again later.
Right. Well, we are talking with Rob Levine, asking this question. Are creators really thriving in the digital age? And Rob Levine, you think it doesn't quite look that way, but your real point finally in the piece for Billboard that prompted us to give you a call was that when it comes to questions, Stephen Johnson isn't asking the right one, or at least you don't think so.
I'm even going to go beyond that because I filed the Billboard piece before I had thought about it as much as I wanted to, which is sort of one of the perils of daily, of, you know, working on a deadline. I thought about it more, and I have another question, which is, beyond are we asking the right question, are we measuring the right thing? Stephen Johnson's sense is that what we want to see is more musicians making more money to make more music. That sounds like a very good outcome. But let me ask you another question. This year, there's 350 TV shows being made. I can't prove this, but I don't know anyone in the entertainment business, and I have pretty good sources, who thinks that all 350 of those shows are going to do well. Well, so why isn't it a good thing that we have more TV? The point of a market is not to make sure that you have more people doing something and getting paid more. The point of a market is to make sure that you have the right kind of people doing the right kind of stuff that someone's going to buy, right? Like, you know, we don't want more television shows. We want more television shows that people want to watch in a way that they want to watch them. You only get that with a market. You can also have too much of something, by the way. Like, you know, if you were to measure the number of our nation's lawyers, right, depending on how you measured it, you might conclude that the legal profession has never been more healthy. There's a lot of lawyers making a lot of money. But if you know anything about the law profession, and I should say I don't know much, but this clearly seems to be the case, you have a lot more lawyers than ever. They may be making a lot more money in the aggregate, but that's because the people at the top are making a lot of money. A lot of people are making no money at all. We probably have too many people going to law school. Some of them may not have the right skills. I don't want to ever say there are too many musicians because it sounds sort of cruel, but I tried to play guitar when I was a kid. If I was somehow getting paid by the government to play music, that would be a huge mistake for the government, for me, and for everybody, because I was terrible at it. If the market for novels were such that I could sell a novel for a lot of money, that would be bad because I have no ability to write a novel. What we don't want people doing as much as possible. You know, you can't weigh this stuff. We want to channel people into doing something that there's a demand for in a way that grows the economy. And I don't think you can measure that by how many are doing this in a broad sense. You have to get pretty specific.
And as far as that marketplace goes, it's your contention in your book, Free Ride, as well as in the piece for Billboard, and just generally as you speak around the country and around the world on these particular topics, is that that marketplace can exist only where a viable form of copyright exists as well.
Yeah, I would say a viable enforcement, not viable copyright. But yeah, and just to be clear, we've gone over this before. So, I'm not necessarily in favor of insanely draconian copyright enforcement. You know, what you need is enough copyright enforcement to establish a functioning market. You know, when I was a kid and people would sort of tape albums, you know, the tapes they made of the albums weren't that good. People wanted to buy the albums. There was some level of piracy, but it was not so high that it endangered the market. People were still, generally speaking, paying for stuff. And that got you some incredibly, you know, that got you some heavy metal bands, some punk bands, some cool bands, some uncool bands, some hip hop, some jazz. There's a lot of stuff. Some of it was good. Some of it wasn't bad. But people were doing stuff that other people valued and wanted to buy. I'm not sort of a market fundamentalist by any means. I guess I think it's sort of, you know, the worst model aside from all the others. But a market's very good at sort of finding out what people want and giving it to them. And that's what we want. We want people to be making music that other people want to listen to.
Rather than making it for themselves, if you will. I mean, we can all be writers if we're just writing in our journals. But you want a marketplace where what we write is of interest to others as well.
Right. And just to be clear, we may want people to make music as a hobby also. So you have to, one of the hard things about all this data is you're looking at two things, right? One is, what kind of music do we want people making as a profession? The market seems like a good way to determine that. The other question is, what kind of music do we want people to make as a hobby? And the answer is sort of, you know, whatever they want to do. I don't think policy discussions really get into this. It's a bit aside from the issues you're talking about here, but you know, hobbyists are great. Also, you just have to sort of measure them differently. What we're seeing now, some people would say it's new. I don't actually think it's new. You're just seeing it more, is that the line between an amateur and a hobbyist is a bit unclear. People say this is a creation of the internet and that, you know, we have to sort of be very respectful of it because it's a new trend. You know, if you grew up listening to music and making that a big part of your life, I don't really see that. I mean, every professional musician, not every, just about every professional musician started out as an amateur musician. You know, I like this. I'm good at it. I'll give myself a few years to make a living at it and see how it goes. Very few people said, you know, I actually don't like this. I'm just doing it for it's just a career. You know, it's just like going to the office. I'm sure somebody did it, but I have a hard time picking out anyone. No one comes to mind. So, you know, the question is sort of, okay. And then one thing he did a good job of is, you know, he didn't count the hobbyists. You know, a lot more albums are being created. Some of them have a little economic value. You know, like there's a lot of albums on iTunes that are bought by five people. I'm not suggesting they're bad albums. I haven't heard them. And I don't think that's a bad thing. But it's hard to look at that and say there's economic value there. There may be moral and artistic value. There may be economic value at some other point, but there's not economic value then. And if you're trying to measure economic value, how do you measure that? Like one of the things that's interesting, so let's say that five times as much music measured by hour, five times as much music was created this year as it was 5 years ago, right? And today's music rocks 2.4 times as hard, right? So collectively, we as a nation are rocking seven times harder. It starts to sound a bit ridiculous, right?
It sounds like we're going in a direction that this podcast really shouldn't go.
But I'm trying to tell you about our GRP, our gross rock product. But
gross rock.
There is a serious point here. And the serious point is, do you want twice as much music? The answer is you don't know. Many people would say, you know, my favorite album is as good as these 10 albums. We don't necessarily want more music. We want better music. How do you measure that? The answer is, I don't really know. I just don't really know. And I don't want to hide behind that and say, hey, you know, we shouldn't discuss this stuff because it's somehow undiscussable. But I think it's fair to say, you know, that the best way to figure out what's good is to sort of figure out what people respond to on some level. You know, the market has always gone along with other models like patrons and academia and grants, and that's a good thing. That's important too. But if you try to sort of say, look at how many people are producing how much stuff, which, by the way, is a great way to look at steel and soybeans, I just don't think it's a very good way to look at music.
Well, it's a serious point and very entertainingly put, and we really appreciate the chance to return to speak with Rob Levine, who is commenting on a recent article by Stephen Johnson, the New York Times Magazine, about the so-called creative apocalypse that never really materialized. Rob has his own commentary in Billboard and has appeared on Beyond the Book in the past, and we're very happy you could join us again. Rob Levine, thank you for speaking with Beyond the Book today.
Thank you very much.
And we'll just have to tell you next time, take it easy on drummers because our producer is one.
Oh,
and,
no! Sorry!
Anyway, on that note, Rob Levine, thank you so much. This is Chris Keneally for Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow us on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book. Mm-hmm.